And good afternoon, everyone. I will call to order the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we will start, as we always do, with a roll call. And Ms. Niedernhofer, please call the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Golden.
Present.
Damon.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen. Grunhagen. Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Present.
Kwan.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. So we're going to hold off.
Glenn Grunhagen, I'm present. I had a little problem with my technical.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. I think we've got you there then.
Madam Chair, while you're at it, Representative Bonner is here too.
Okay. Anybody else we missed before we go on? Okay. Very good. And members, I believe that if you join a moment or two late and you miss the roll call, that Ms. Niedernhofer does notice you and add you to the roll. So thank you. And thank you, everybody, for being so prompt. I mean, I've noticed this committee, you all are extraordinarily prompt and really do appreciate that. I know sometimes issues happen. Anyway, we're gonna pass on the minutes today. We need to make a correction to those. And so the first thing on our agenda today is to have a presentation from DHS on dental services in public programs. And I just want to preface this by saying that there is a proposal in the governor's budget concerning this. We don't have the actual bill before us yet. And in fact, my understanding is that the proposal is kind of a work in progress a little bit, but it's a pretty big issue. And I know that those of you who were here last year in 2019, I should say, know that this is an issue that's been on the table for a while. And it's, as you know, we cover dental as part of our public programs. And we also have some real challenges in our state with getting dental care to people who are on our public programs. And so we're taking up an overview of this today, just kind of a preview of what the issues are here. And so Assistant Commissioner Anderson has agreed to be here to give us a presentation on this. So I'm gonna turn it over to him and welcome to the committee. And we can't hear you. And now we really can't hear you as you're frozen. Okay. Looks like we might be getting something, but we still can't hear you. No. We're not hearing you, Mr. Anderson. Okay, I think he's gonna try to sign back in here. In the meantime, I could just say that I think that we will have other proposals coming in this area. And just to kind of continue laying the groundwork, and I think he has some good slides to show us to sort of frame up the issue and the problem and where we've been. But there I see Representative Ryer. I think Representative Ryer is working on this issue for us, and I think working on a bill to probably make or some language at least that will possibly, before the bill gets to us, will have modified it somewhat. So anyway, I hope we'll be able to hear Mr. Anderson now. We're not hearing you, Mr. Anderson. Oh, the wonders of technology. Okay, I wonder if, do we have anybody else? I see we have someone else from DHS. Maybe we can get started a little bit.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is Giovo Hayes with the Department of Human Services. If you can hear me, I'd be happy to begin the presentation, and then Mr. Anderson can certainly take over as soon as his technology allows.
Absolutely, we can hear you.
Great, I think Ms. Voss will pull up the slides for us. Mr. Anderson, feel free to interrupt me as soon as you're ready. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Giovo. I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'm the manager of rates and policy within the Medicaid and Minnesota Care Programs. We can move to the next slide, please. So today, for your request, Madam Chair, we're going to talk a little bit about dental services within the public health care programs, which encompasses both medical assistance and Minnesota care. We do have two different benefit sets when it comes to dental services. So as you see at the top of your screen, medical assistance covers a comprehensive benefit set for dental for children up to 21 and pregnant women as well. The children up to 21 is a federal requirement under the Early Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment Program, which is in Social Security federal law. But on top of that, as many of you probably know, medical assistance has a lot of optional benefits, and most of those benefits are really optional for the adult side. And so dental is one of those. It's an optional benefit for adults. So for adults in Minnesota, we have a limited benefit set that's adults over the age of 21 in the Medicaid program. And this largely changed back in 2008 during the state budget deficit as a way to save some additional dollars. We did limit the adult dental benefits in Medicaid. Minnesota Care has a similar benefit set, but just slightly different age ranges. So the comprehensive benefit set is available for children up to 19, and then the limited benefit set for adults 19 and over. It's the same benefit set, but just derived differently by ages. Next slide, please. I think Mr. Anderson is ready to go, so I'll pass it off to him if that's the case.
All right. Mr. Anderson?
Hello, Madam Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Oh, fantastic. I apologize to you, Madam Chair, and to the committee members for the technical problems. Not sure exactly what happened, but I've joined by phone now, and hopefully this will hold steady. Thank you for Giovo Hayes to get us started, and really thank him for being available for questions and keeping me on the straight and narrow. Madam Chair, as you indicated at the beginning of the hearing, that we've had challenges in our dental program for several years and have struggled to figure out ways to make sure that our enrollees are really getting the care that we need. As Commissioner Harp said, we'll often say there's no health without dental health. And today, and for several years, particularly children in our programs, fewer than 40% are getting a dental visit each year. Those reports go back into 1999 in the access issues and challenges that we've had. So the efforts by the department over the years have really been focused on how do we increase access, how do we get more of our enrollees getting the services that they need, and especially those preventative services that help them lead a higher quality of life, but also help reduce other utilization and spending in our programs that could be avoided by better access and better services in our dental benefits. Next slide. So as we talk about the proposal in the governor's budget and about the policy objectives we have in trying to address some of these issues, these are, as we look at the future of our dental program, these are some of the high-level policy objectives that we're working to better ensure access to those. And those are four main policy objectives: a fair payment rate for providers, more simplified rate structure for our providers, removing barriers to provider participation, and paying for outcomes and quality. Next slide. So when we compare our program and services to those in the dental community, we know that today the Medicaid and Minnesota care programs are not great payers, for lack of a better term, for low reimbursement is largely and widely regarded as one of the challenges in our program and for our enrollees to be able to get care. Our current rates, and I want to make sure that my phone is working right so that you actually hear, our current rates are based on provider charges from 1989. That 1989, I mean, think of your hairstyle back in 1989. That's when our rates were based. The cost of delivering services obviously has changed significantly in 32 years. And even just in the last year, when we think of the way that care is being delivered now because of COVID-19 and the additional costs and infection prevention measures that providers need to take. Several national studies of dental reimbursement rates in Medicaid programs have ranked Minnesota as having some of the lowest reimbursement rates in the country, including a report from 2017 by the American Dental Association that ranked us 49th among states for Medicaid reimbursement. And several years ago, the department completed a study comparing our reimbursements to our state employee group insurance program, or CGIP, and found that our base rate is only 47% of what the payments are through CGIP. And even after adding in our add-on payments or other adjustments that we make, the average payment is still just barely over half of what a provider would get for the same service delivering it to a state employee in our CDIP program. Next slide. We talked about earlier about simplified rate structure. Today, there are multiple different potential add-ons that providers can get to the base rate based on the enrollee that they're serving, where they're providing the service, what kind of clinic they are. These are some of the examples. Again, these are built on top of a 1989 charges structure. And you'll see that there's, you know, these are just six different add-ons that can apply in certain situations. And what they result in is because of these add-ons and applying in different scenarios, there are at least nine different payment rates that we pay for a standard dental cleaning, depending on if it was to a child or an adult, if it was outside the metro area, what type of provider was doing the service. And that kind of complexity makes it very difficult for providers to really able to have a lot of security or confidence about how much they will get paid for a service and the fact that they're juggling different payments and different rates from our program. Next slide. We also talked about one of the objectives is reducing the barriers to provider participation. We talked about the complexity of our rate structure as being a barrier. We also have barriers with credentialing and the benefit limitations that we have in the services that we provide. And providers who participate have to enroll in Medicaid. They also have to go through credentialing for our fee-for-service program and then go through pretty much the same process when they go into each of the managed care organizations and county-based purchasing plans to be able to serve members in their areas. And so this results in different fee schedules, different credentialing processes, duplication of processes, different utilization limits, different prior authorization rules, all of those kinds of complexities that can be frustrating and costly for providers. Next slide. And fourth, I mentioned that the objective of paying for outcomes, and this is really looking at our program and seeing how can we in the dental community create a payment structure that pays for and recognizes high quality care, outcomes for the patient, not just the number of services delivered, but actual health outcomes. Today, our services and our payment structures are largely based around the volume of services that a provider delivers. And it doesn't necessarily recognize the great work being done by providers who really advance oral health strategies such as addressing social determinants of health or developing dental homes, coordinating care and services, providing services in alternative delivery locations to make care more accessible. So a large group of our dental community providers have been working for more than a year on a dental home concept to bring forward an arrangement that would better support a value-based incentive program. DHS, Giogo Hayes and Dr. Linda Manti have been fortunate to be able to participate in some of these conversations with leadership from our Dental Services Advisory Committee. Really want to thank them and our Dental Services Advisory Committee for their work to look at opportunities to build new models and to collaborate with our provider community. And so through models like dental homes, our dental program could move to a more value-based system and incentivizing providers for delivering high quality care, improving oral health, and addressing social determinants of health going forward. Next slide. So as you know, and in the governor's budget proposal, we have a proposal based on a strategy that was discussed by the Blue Ribbon Commission. Again, this really tried to get at those objectives that we discussed earlier. The strategy that was developed and discussed is only one strategy. It's not the only way to address these objectives, but it was designed to try to advance these goals. Part of it is on getting to a more fair rate was increasing the rate for adults by 54%. Children have already had a significant base rate increase recently, and so increasing it by 24.4% is to keep it in line with the 54% rate increase for adults. This would make a more fair and simple rate. There's no real magic to these numbers. These were numbers based on our budgeting and trying to figure out how much savings we could generate in other areas to be able to make this investment in dental services. But we think that it's a significant increase that would make it more attractive for more providers to be able to deliver services to our enrollees. We would repurpose some of the current spending in the program to create more targeted rate add-ons into this across-the-board rate increase. We'd also contract with a uniform administrator to allow providers to contract and credential with only one entity to serve the entire 1.3 million people that enroll in our public programs, rather than the fragmented process that they have today in working with our fee-for-service program and potentially up to 8 different managed care organizations. And then, like I said, really paying for outcomes and quality, building on the work that's being done by our Dental Services Advisory Committee and the dental provider community in how do we move to recognizing quality outcomes. And this could be through dental homes and possibly a pilot program. Like I said, the strategy that the Blue Ribbon Commission developed and that's in the governor's budget is a strategy that we feel will advance these objectives, but we want to be clear that it's not the only strategy, and we really appreciated the work and collaboration with our provider community to look at options and alternatives and be able to see if there's ways that we can better improve the services for our enrollees. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to keep my comments limited and be happy to take questions and also look to, again, my colleagues, Giogo Hayes and others from DHS to be able to help respond to questions if you have any.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I think that brief overview gives just a tiny taste of how complicated this is. And it is really complicated. Yeah. And one thing I would ask you, and I'm happy to take other members' questions as well, but your discussion of the rates paid was focused around fee-for-service. And, you know, of course, this I continue to beat the same horse. I wouldn't say that it's dead, however. I think it's a live horse, unfortunately, I guess. No, that's a terrible analogy. We don't beat our horses. But anyway, the issue about PMAP rates, and of course, DHS has data that the legislature doesn't have about what is paid to providers under PMAP. I understand that under the county-based purchasing, because those rates are not private, those rates are public data, I think, like pretty much else that goes on in county-based purchasing, we probably do know what those rates are. And I have heard at times that those organizations are able to pay dentists more, or do pay dentists more, and are able to get more participation from dentists. But can you speak to at all, even in a general sense, what it looks like when the rates are paid through PMAP or through the MCOs, or comparing, you know, how does that compare for fee for service? Are they equally low? Are they getting better participation? You know, anything you can tell us kind of off the top of your head here.
Sure. So thank you, Madam Chair. What I can say is, we know that as a general matter, that managed care organizations generally pay more than the fee-for-service rates as a general rule. Again, our rate structure is very complicated, and so it's hard to say that every managed care payment is higher than a fee-for-service payment, because once you build those add-ons in, that may not be necessarily the case. But generally speaking, managed care organizations are able to pay more. The managed care program allows for managed care organizations to have that flexibility to design and negotiate their own payment structures with providers, and be able to try to entice providers to participate in the program and address other issues that they may need to be able to build their networks. That being said, it's important to note that providers still report that it's very difficult for them to know how much they're going to get paid, whether it's from fee-for-service or from a managed care organization, that it's the rates are complicated and uncertain. We still have significant access issues. Again, when we talk about 40% of our children, only 40% being able to get a dental visit in a year, many of those children are covered in managed care. And so that this is not an issue that is solely a fee-for-service issue. This is an issue that's across the board. And one of the reasons why that the strategy that's in the governor's proposal is really to carve out the benefit from managed care, administer all of it together, so that there is a single structure and a single administrator, to be able to get greater transparency and to be able to get greater uniformity or standardization across the program.
Okay, so thank you. And I hope members see a theme here, a little bit of a theme. And Mr. Anderson, just one follow-up question, and then I'll go to Representative Pryor. But so in the governor's proposal, what does that administrator look like? I mean, there are different issues in the proposal. One is the carve out itself, and then who would be the administrator instead of all the different ones we have now. And then, of course, we have a sort of a separate but related issue about how payments could be changed and all those other delivery issues. But just on the carve out piece, who is going to be the administrator under that program?
That would be a decision that would be presumably that would be made later. The way that the proposal is designed, we would be carving the benefit out from managed care, and so DHS would technically administer the program. But we've designed it in a way that we would issue an RFP and do a procurement to be able to get a vendor who would be able to administer that on our behalf and hopefully achieve efficiencies of scale and expertise around that. But that would be determined through a competitive RFP process, not something that I could say today it's going to be Acme Corporation or something like that. That would be a competitive process.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Pryor and then Ryer. And then Grunhagen, I think, is next. So, okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that I will not leave this meeting understanding everything about our public dental programs. And no matter how many questions I ask, so I'll try to just be brief and just talk in a high level, or just ask my question at a high level. So, as the chair alluded to, you know, it seems like even to know the what the rates are and what's being paid is not always transparent and public information. So, you know, in this new version of how we're doing it, will those rates actually be transparent? Will that be public information that the legislature can know about? And then just as a follow-up, is it seems like in some ways, you know, when we have managed care, we have a vendor that's doing this. And so is it just like pulling more into that kind of managed care situation is what we're going to be doing in the future?
Mr. Anderson.
Was two questions. And if it can't be answered in a way that's totally clear, that I understand, it's fine. I trust you. And just because I know that it will take a while before I fully need to understand everything that's involved in this. And I'm just hoping that the bill author does when it comes time.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pryor. I am on my own learning curve in this area. I so appreciate that this is complex and very difficult to get your arms around all at once. The way that we've approached this, or the proposal that the governor is bringing forward, would really set a, for all intents and purposes, set a standard fee schedule that would apply to all providers. And that would be the fee schedule that the administrator would be paying. And so there would be significantly more transparency and a lot more standardization, because it would all be, here's the fee schedule. The advantage of having an administrator be able to manage it is really around the administration of the program itself, around credentialing providers, identifying provider enrollment and being able to handle those. I don't mean this to sound pejorative, but sort of the back office work of managing the program, so that when enrollees have a question, they call that one administrator. That administrator can find providers for them, can get them information that they need, those kinds of things. Again, that maybe theoretically could be something that DHS does on its own, but we've set up the proposal in a way that we have the ability to contract for it, anticipating that this is something that that another organization probably can do better and more efficiently than we can. But the rate structure itself, this would not be a managed care organization contract in the sense of giving them a capitated payment and then they would decide how much to pay providers and negotiate rates. It would be a fee structure. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, okay, great. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I fully support the goals that you've outlined here. They're very encouraging with the goal of bringing up access, especially to ensure that all children have the care that they need. My question is around the rates themselves and thinking about the modeling you're doing and how it's not about the rates even, it's how do we get from here to there? So when I think about it, looking at the different dental clinic systems, looking at the different locations, what they're currently receiving and what they would receive under the new system, because my worry is that with the critical access dental clinic systems that we have, that they're going to end up, just because things are getting averaged, taking a hit, and they're the right ones who are carrying the water for us right now. So my question is, how are you doing it and how are you thinking about that? And I'm going to be involved in this, so that we'll have many more conversations about it.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Breyer, thank you for the question. You're absolutely correct that the way that, you know, when you deal with averages, that has disparate impacts across the sector. One of the objectives as we look at access issues, right now, a large majority of our enrollees who receive services are receiving them from critical access dental clinics. And so that infrastructure is absolutely essential for the state to be able to continue to provide access. But we also believe that it's probably not sufficient to provide the level of access we need to get us from where we are today to where we need to be. We need more providers participating in the program. And so somehow we have to be able to create the incentives, including financial incentives, to get them into the program and serving our enrollees. So we believe that increasing rates needs to be part of the equation. At the same time, as you know, we have budget realities. There's not an unlimited amount of money. And so in trying to design this the way that we have is to, like I said, bring in new money from savings elsewhere in our Medicaid and Minnesota Care programs. So we are spending in total, we are spending more on dental services and trying to simplify those rates and spread them out. But I don't want to hide the ball. I don't want to be cute or clever about it. It is likely that because of the way those add-ons work today, that critical access dental clinics would likely see a decrease in some of their rates or in some of their payments. And so we're very sensitive to that. Like I said, we've enjoyed the opportunity to have good, productive conversations with our critical access dental care providers and members of the dental community to be able to see is there ways that we could mitigate some of that? Are there ways that we can make sure that we don't destabilize the system by doing this? Without question, we are trying to raise the boats, but we don't have enough, at least in the budget circumstances that we're in, we don't have enough to only increase some providers' payments and leave others whole and still get to the outcomes we think we need to get to.
Representative Ryer?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And thank you for that answer. And I'm gonna go to Representative Grunhagen, but just let me just say for members who've been around for a while, when we do some kind of reorganization, it's so much easier to do that when you've got money so that you can keep everybody whole. And when you don't, it becomes an incredible challenge. So yeah, I hope that we're in a year when we don't have to have, when we can actually make real progress, because this is a problem that's been admired from different angles ever since I've been in the legislature, which is a while now. So, right, Representative Grunhagen, you too, you've been involved in this a long time. Go ahead, please. And we can't hear you.
Oh, I was just going to say, amen. We've been on down this path before. So yeah, that's really, Representative Ryer covered most of my question and you responded to it. Is, you know, out of the rural area, it's already a crisis to get access out here for lower income people. I mean, there's only like one dentist within 20 miles that I'm aware of that even accepts them. And the fact is he's an older dentist. He's got things paid up. I did get a bill passed to get rid of the 10%. That helps some. They do take some, but some of these younger dentists, they've got a lot of debt buying these practices out or whatever they do, and they just can't afford to take this reimbursement. So when we go to this new system, my concern is, and you kind of seem to confirm it, they're going to get even less than what they're getting right now. And that's not going to help access. That's just going to hurt access. And so I'd rather stick with what we got to give them at least what they're getting versus at a time of budget crunch. You know, we'll see what the February forecast says, but I don't want to give them less, because I've heard, my sister used to work for a dentist for years, for over 20 years. And I know most of the dentists in the area. And, you know, whenever I bring up the idea of reimbursement under medical assistance, they're not happy, let's put it that way, okay? And that's probably the best way to put it. But I just don't want to go to this system if we're gonna short rural providers even more than what they're already losing when they take these patients. Any additional comments?
Mr. Anderson, do you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, you're correct, and we struggle with that those realities. I think everyone at DHS and our Dental Services Advisory Committee, and I'm sure all of the dental providers would, as Representative Liebling, or Madam Chair, as you indicated, if we were in in a different budget scenario, and we could bring everyone up to the rates that the critical access dental clinics were getting paid, or at some level that was closer to or equal to what commercial payers are paying, that would be an easy way, an expensive way, but an easy way to be able to increase access and increase participation. We're trying to figure out a way that we can address the challenges that we see, the problems that we've had, within the financial constraints that we have, and absolutely, like I said, want to be clear and recognize that that the proposal does have the ramifications that we've been talking about here, and if there are ways to mitigate those, if there are other avenues that we can explore, the department is, like I said, we've been very encouraged by the conversations that we've had with our dental providers and other alternatives. And we want to be able to keep those options open, and we want to be able to keep the discussions open so that we can either, even if it's not this session, if there's a time in the future when we can make those all boats rise kinds of decisions, we want to be best positioned to be able to do that.
Okay, and thank you. And Representative Ryer, final word on this topic, and then we'll move on to our first bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, respond slightly to Representative Grünhagen, just in terms of saying we are, from my perspective, at the beginning of the process of thinking through all of the good ideas that I'm hearing from people and seeing from people. And I'm an optimist and am hopeful that we will be able to take all of these puzzle pieces and move towards something that does something as sweet in the spot as the middle as we can. So,
yeah, thank you, Representative Ryer. Really appreciate that. And this is such a complicated issue. And I guess I would just conclude by saying that, you know, I think, speaking just for myself, what I care most about is making sure that people on our programs get the care they need. It is really important to have dental health for your physical health. This is, you know, the idea that we are sending kids to school with rotting teeth so they can't learn, that really, I don't like that idea at all. And yet, I'm sure that's what's happening here in our state. So that's what really matters to me. And, you know, not so much what a dentist gets, what a clinic gets, as long as we keep them there to provide the service. And, you know, that is my value behind all of this. So it's not what they get, it's what the state gets. And, you know, knowing that we need to have providers there and have them able to give access to our patients. So just that's the frame that I continue with. And thank you, everybody, for your hard work. And I know it is really a challenge. So we're going to move on to House File 838, Representative Bierman, speaking about one of the things that Mr. Anderson listed there. He had one of his slides had a list, and I think one of those was benefits. And speaking of benefits, so Representative Bierman is going to move House File 838 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So, Representative Bierman, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I'm very pleased to present House File 838 to you all. This legislation has been around a few sessions, actually. I saw it for my first time last session as a new legislator and was presented with this bill, and I immediately signed on to it. It had bipartisan support back then, and I'm hopeful that we can get that again this year and we can get this across the finish line this year as well. So what this bill is this bill would add in the much needed dental benefit back into coverage for adults on Medicaid. There are two common diseases of the mouth, tooth decay and periodontal or gum disease. Coverage for basic treatment of periodontal disease was eliminated in 2009 when the state was suffering from a budget deficit in the billions. That year, half of all adult benefits were were eliminated from the benefit structure. That year, half of all the adult benefits were eliminated, including this particular benefit, which is shown to save thousands and thousands of dollars in medical care costs for patient populations with chronic diseases, such as heart disease and diabetes. So periodontitis always begins with inflammation of the gums, known as gingivitis. This inflammation can then spread below the gums and along the roots of the teeth and cause permanent damage to the tissues around the teeth and to the supporting bone. Around 40% of people suffer from periodontitis. Among adults, it is estimated that around 70% of tooth loss is caused by periodontitis. Left untreated, it can lead to more expensive treatment for other health problems, as well as to hospitalizations. Sometimes gum disease treatment is required before a patient can undergo other needed care, including cardiovascular or heart surgery or organ transplants and even some forms of chemotherapy. In general, it costs more to leave gum disease untreated than it would be to treat it. Advocates have numerous studies from health insurance companies showing that treatment of gum disease actually reduces overall medical costs for patients with a number of chronic health care issues, including heart disease, diabetes, dementia, and others. I sent three of those studies to you all, and I want to highlight one study in particular. In 2016, Avalara Health, a healthcare consulting firm headquartered in Washington, D.C., that specializes in strategy, policy, and data analysis for health plans, providers, government agencies, and industry associations, provided a study that estimated the cost or savings to the Medicare program of a new benefit covering the initial and ongoing treatment of periodontal disease for beneficiaries with diabetes, heart disease, or stroke. They estimated that providing a periodontal disease benefit in Medicare would produce savings of $63.5 billion. That's billion dollars between 2016 and 2025. This would largely be related to fewer hospitalizations and emergency room visits. So today I have a couple testifiers, Madam Chair, but would like to note the letters of support also in your packet from the Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association, the Minnesota Dental Association, Dental Access Partners, the Board of Dentistry, and the Oral Health Alliance, in addition to NAMI. So we could go to testifiers next, Madam Chair. That would be great.
Yes, thank you, Representative Bierman, for that great introduction to the bill. So we have a couple of testifiers. First, we have Jessica Flotterud. Welcome. Please just introduce yourself with your name and your affiliation, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jessica Flotterud, and I'm the Executive Director at Hope Dental Clinic. Hope Dental Clinic grew from a dental program at the Union Gospel Mission Twin Cities, and our goal was and is to serve the underserved. While most of our patient base are those without insurance, we also see patients on medical assistance in Minnesota Care during special events that we hold throughout the year. We provide care to very complex patients, many of which have very complex dental problems. At Hope Dental Clinic, we actually find that 80% of our patients that come in for preventive care need scaling and replaning. And I've been informed from other community clinics that some of them are seeing rates at 60% of their patients needing this deeper cleaning. Now with COVID, we expect to see a continued increase in prevalence of periodontal disease due to the many people that have been putting off dental treatment due to fear. If over half of the underserved face a disease, periodontal disease, and are unable to get it treated, it very well may cause disease in other parts of the body. Did you know that the mouth is often referred to as a mirror of the body? You can tell a lot about a person's overall health by simply looking at their oral health. Untreated dental disease can contribute to endocarditis, cardiovascular disease, pregnancy and birth complications, and pneumonia. Simply put, patients on Medicaid who are unable to treat their periodontal disease because it's not a covered benefit is leading to much higher medical costs for the state and possibly more health problems that could have been avoided. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in front of your committee and to let you know just how important this benefit is to our neighbors in Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flatterud. Appreciate you being here today. And now we have Dr. Mary Sayro. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mary Sayro, Chair of the Department of Dentistry at Hennepin Healthcare. Thank you for letting me testify today on why periodontal coverage should be added back to the Medicaid benefit set. This proposal makes sense both from a healthcare point of view, but also from a financial one. And today I'm speaking on behalf of Dental Access Partners, which includes AppleTree Dental, Community Dental Care, and Hennepin Healthcare. Given the broad support and understanding of why restoring these services are important, I'm just going to make three key points. The first is that medical assistance currently covers treatment of only one of the two main diseases that affect oral health. One is tooth decay. It's a bacterial infection of the tooth, and treatment is covered. Treatment of periodontal disease, which is also a bacterial infection, is not covered. And this bill simply corrects that problem by adding back a basic essential benefit to treat periodontal disease. Second, this is what's best for our patients. Periodontal disease is the leading cause of tooth loss in adults, which has long-term impact on health, quality of life, and self-esteem. The final point is economics. Studies show that untreated oral disease leads to higher medical costs for patients with certain chronic diseases, and that patients with those conditions who receive periodontal services have significantly lower overall medical care costs. For example, for heart disease, in some of these studies, the savings was $1,000 per patient per year. For a patient with cardiovascular disease, $5,000 per year. For a patient with diabetes, $2,800 per year. And in Minnesota, we have about 467,000 patients with diabetes. If we're able to treat an underlying disease that can lower these costs, then why wouldn't we do this? I encourage you to support this bill, and thank you so much again, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sayro. We appreciate you being here with us today. Are there any questions from members? I'm not seeing any, and I just do want to tell members of the committee that we don't have a fiscal note on this. Obviously, it will have one. We are getting one, and probably we're not going to get some of these fiscal notes until after we have the forecast come out, which is what we need in order to get an accurate fiscal note. So, but this is being laid over for possible inclusion, so we definitely will know the cost before we would actually move the bill out of this committee. So I just want to once again thank our testifiers, and we have others on the call here that do work with our population and that with these great needs, and just want to appreciate all of you for the work that you do. Thank you. And Representative Munson does have his hand up. Representative Munson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my my question, whoops, I got the wrong video on here. My question is actually, I don't know if the bill author or someone from the industry can answer, but in rural Minnesota, we have a very big shortage of doctors that treat people of lower income, and adding additional services that would be available to people when they can't find dentists to perform the normal services today, that this bill doesn't obviously address that need. Is it going to, I mean, where's the solution for adding additional services when the doctors are not available?
So Representative Munson, I guess I'll take a quick stab at that, and then maybe Dr. Sayro would want to answer too. But one, I would say to you that you can't fix everything in one bill, first of all. And we're hearing several things today that address different aspects of this. So it is a multifaceted problem, and it's not going to be, of course, all solved by adding one additional service. However, it is my understanding, I'm sure Dr. Sayro can speak to this, that, you know, if you're going to take a patient out in greater Minnesota somewhere, and you're not going to get paid for a big chunk of what they need, I assume that that's going to not exactly help incentivize you to take that patient. So I'm not sure putting this benefit back in would, in fact, I'm sure it won't solve the whole problem, but it may make the problem just a little bit less severe. Dr. Syro, could you help me out here?
Yes. Well, for one thing, not having this benefit is a huge frustration for dentists. And actually, I think at the point that we dropped these services, dentists dropped out. The Minnesota Dental Association strongly supports this bill, and as does our membership. And you're right in that we're sometimes providing. It puts dentists in an unethical kind of dilemma where I'm going to restore decay on teeth that are periodontally compromised. So it puts us in a bad situation, and it actually drives people away from participating.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thank you. And okay, last comment from Representative Bonner, and then we're going to lay the bill over. Representative Bonner.
I just want to thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing the bill forward in particular. And I know this has been a long going issue. I've paid for dental appointments for my uncovered nephews for years. And I will tell you, I've been in a perio maintenance program. And what's an interesting dichotomy is that most health plans, as they mentioned, do cover a regular cleaning. But if you need perio maintenance, you either pay out of pocket or you get no benefit. I mean, there's none. Or we place providers in a weird position where we're asking them to perform a regular cleaning when they know a much deeper cleaning is required. And in fact, I had one dentist who refused to even give me the regular cleaning because the perio wasn't required or wasn't paid for. So I think, realistically, this is clearly a gap that we need to do something about. We can't be forcing providers into these weird, awkward positions. And certainly it's not a good situation for parents or for patients either. Now, I purposely pay for all the additional visits to go out of my own pocket every year to get this maintenance work done because I think it's important. But the reality is not everybody's in that place. And so I think having at least some access to these services is really important. So I appreciate the bill. Thank you to Ms. Syro for coming forward and for Representative Bierman.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And thanks for the question, Representative Munson, because I think it's an important point, I think, that needed to be added here. So with that, the bill is laid over
Madam
for
Chair.
Possible inclusion in the finance bill. Oh, I'm sorry,
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Bierman.
I did want to just follow up on Dr. Sayuro's comment because I could hear in her statement her frustration about, and I think it relates back to what they put in their letter about the fact that dentists have a pledge which aspires to total health and wellness, and they are unable to deliver that service without this fundamental basic coverage. So hope that all members will consider it and will go ahead and acknowledge the fact that we will get a fiscal note. It will be a significant amount, but the savings will be even higher. So that's something that we can't speculate on, but we know it's there, and other states have taken it out and put it back in when they realize their error. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Bierman. So the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in our finance bill. So next up is Senate File 475, and Representative Freiberg, welcome. And this bill, so Representative Freiberg is going to move Senate File 475 to be recommended to the General Register. And Representative Freiberg has an author's amendment, the A1. And Representative Freiberg is going to move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which he would like to discuss it. Representative Freiberg.
Sure. The A1 amendment would just have the authority sunset on June 1st, 2022, which would give the legislature time to consider a permanent change to the scope of practice. So should we just adopt the amendment and then I can describe the bill?
I think that would be the best. So please unmute yourselves, members. So all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. All right. Thank you. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Thank you. To your bill, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Dentists are members of our healthcare community and want to do their part to help administer the COVID-19 vaccine to Minnesotans. Dentists are trained and often give injections to their patients. Administering the COVID-19 vaccine would be in line with what they are capable of doing and are trained to do. Under Minnesota law, dentists are currently able to administer the flu vaccine as well. A dentist could serve as additional healthcare provider workforce and support large vaccine efforts across the state. We see a valuable role they could play in administering the vaccine in community settings and working with local public health. Dentists could also help vaccinate Minnesotans in rural parts of the state and help minimize the travel time necessary to get the vaccine. Over 20 states have already taken action to allow dentists to administer the COVID-19 vaccine, and more are in the process of doing so. Having a large, strong, and reliable provider workforce to vaccinate the population will help ensure that when the state receives vaccine doses, that they get into the arms of Minnesotans as quickly as possible. Passing this legislation quickly will give the Minnesota Dental Association and the Minnesota Board of Dentistry time to notify dentists of this change and ensure that they get any necessary training. This could take a few weeks to make sure that dentists are available and ready to administer the vaccine. With me to testify is Dr. Jim Nickman, president of the Minnesota Dental Association. Carissa Kemp from the Minnesota Dental Association is also available to answer questions, and I understand Director Ayersman from MDH is also here, but I believe to answer questions, but I believe she has to leave in 10 minutes or so.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Welcome, Dr. Nickman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Liebling and Representative Freiberg. Thank you for inviting us today to testify for this bill. My name is Dr. Jim Nickman, and I'm a pediatric dentist who practices in the Twin Cities metro area. I'm currently the president of the Minnesota Dental Association and past president of the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. Throughout this pandemic, dentists have done their part to help minimize the spread of COVID-19. Many of our clinics donated their PPE to hospital and other critical areas during the first month of the pandemic. We also kept our doors open to provide emergency care and help keep people out of the emergency room to preserve precious resources. We have implemented safety protocols in our offices to minimize the spread, and now we want to continue to help the communities and our patients by administering the COVID-19 vaccine. Dentists are highly trained, as was mentioned, healthcare providers who frequently give injections to our patients and are currently authorized to administer the flu vaccine. Due to the nature of the procedures that dentists provide, dentists are trained to administer simple and complex injections of medications, including anesthesia. Dentists are part of the healthcare system, and we want to do our part to help people safe and healthy. We believe that dentists could be a large part of this provider workforce that would help administer the vaccine in community settings. And dentists can also play a critical role in vaccinating Minnesotans in rural parts of the state to help limit the travel time to get vaccinated. We've heard from the dentists who want to help, and we urge your support to allow them to do so to help vaccinate our population and get the COVID monkey off our back. Thank you for our time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nickman. We appreciate your testimony. And we do have one hand up, but I know that Director Ayersman has to leave. And so I just wanted to point out to members, there is a fiscal note, which is a zero cost. And one thing before I go to Representative Munson, I just wanted to point out that under the Department of Health section of the fiscal note, there's some narrative about the fact that the CDC informed the Department of Health that it may require them to conduct on-site visits of all COVID-19 provider sites. And there could be future costs, but that they're, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that they assume that CDC will be covering these costs. And so I just wanted to point that out if there are questions about that for Director Ayersman. And that is one of the reasons to have this revisited at the end of the next legislative session. So there'd be time, as Representative Freiberg pointed out, during the next legislative session to review how this is going and see if this should be a permanent change in scope for dentists, or if it is not being used, or if it's cost has costs associated with it. So I'm going to go to Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question for either the bill's author, I don't know if the Dr. Nickman is still available, but this vaccine is much different than the flu vaccine because it just because of the sheer quantity that has to be available in the location when you're doing this. It's this bill is, correct if I'm wrong, but this bill is not to allow dentists to administer the vaccine in their clinic, but just to allow dentists to go to a mass vaccination event in a town? Or are you really talking about spreading out the vaccines into so many other locations and additional dental offices? Is that the point of what we're going to be doing here? And then I guess, and the follow-up question is, are the dentists going to have access to the medical records of the patients, or are they going to follow up with the family practitioner or the main doctor?
Dr. Dickman.
Sorry, thank you. I think that probably the majority of vaccine administration would probably likely occur in a mass setting. But I could see at some point, especially as other vaccines emerge on the market that don't have rigorous refrigeration requirements or freezing requirements, that potentially that could, the dentist office could be a viable situation. My assumption would be is that we would probably report the vaccine administration through the Minnesota Immunization Information Connection, which physicians would have access to query to see if their patients have been vaccinated. I'm sure in a small community, it's relatively easy to follow up with a regular provider. But large community events, my assumption would be that the organizer would have the reporting organized, similar to a Minnesota Department of Health event. So.
Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Nickman. I guess just to verify, is this software that you're going to be communicating with their doctor entering this vaccine information, is that software that you have available in your clinics now? Or is that required, or is this an additional software that other providers would have to install and use if they were to administer this vaccine?
I would have to get back with you on that. My assumption would be is it would be a website that would be accessed, or you know, some other cost software, but we're so early in the process that I think that's, you know, it's something we need to work out.
And this is where I think Director Erzman could be helpful. I'm not sure if she's still on.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Please go ahead. Chair Liebling and Representative Munson. Yes. I mean, we have the Minnesota Immunization Information Connection, and any provider, any enrolled provider who is administering COVID vaccines needs to report that to us through MIC. If dentists were administering COVID vaccine through a mass site, there would already be a provision for that. If they were administering COVID vaccine in their practice, then we would need to, first of all, they'd need to be enrolled as a COVID provider, and that would involve getting them access to MIC, and obviously that would be dependent on, you know, the number of dentists all at once and the capacity of the agency. But yes, they would be using MIC, and they would have access to that.
Thank you, Director Erzman. So it sounds like, you know, this legislation removes a barrier for dentists to be allowed to help, but it's not everything, I think, is kind of what I drew from what Director Erzman just said. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the doctor, just to verify, I feel very safe when I ever had a procedure in a dental office, but just want to ask a quick question. You're totally equipped to handle any kind of anaphylactic shock. You have airway equipment, you have all the meds needed to reverse what you give. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. You know, we give multiple medications, and we have to be prepared for medical emergencies of all type, including anaphylaxis. So,
Representative Hewitt?
Yep, Madam Chair. And I did have the experience of, I'm one of the ones that got vaccinated actually yesterday. I'm feeling kind of icky today, but to know that, to get to Representative Munson's concerns, I was vaccinated in a large church, and I knew they had the equipment there, and I was asking questions as my name was entered into a database and all of it automatically got fed to this national, to the state database system, and it was just on an iPad. And I would bet that it's simple enough where these physicians and our dentists can have that right in their clinics, and they already have the equipment they need in case something happens. So I feel very secure with this. I think this is a great bill, Representative Freiberg. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Are there other questions? Representative Freiberg, do you want to have the final word here?
Thank you. I appreciate the committee's consideration and questions. I feel it's important to expand, you know, just to make the vaccine as available as possible. I think that's the surest way we're going to get past the pandemic. And I think this is a good step to help increase the potential pool of providers of the vaccine. So I'd encourage your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So Representative Freiberg renews his motion that Senate file 475 be re-referred to the general register. And we need a roll call vote on this one. So Ms. Niedernhofer, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Leach Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Dameth.
Aye.
Dameth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. 19 ayes and 0 nays.
All right. There being 19 ayes and 0 nays, the bill is passed and it's on its way to the general register. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. And thank you, testifiers. So now we're going to move to House File 620, Representative Dameth. And Representative Dameth, a member of our committee, is going to move that House File 620 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Dameth, you have an A1 author's amendment. Is that your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do.
And did you want that now, or do you want to wait to explain it first, or have us adopt it, or what's your pleasure?
Yeah, if we could move that now, okay. And I can give you a brief overview if you'd like.
All right, well, let's adopt the amendment and then you can explain the bill as amended. So Representative Dameth is moving the A1 author's amendment. Please unmute yourselves, members. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right, please explain your bill as amended.
And thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for hearing this bill. I want to say thank you to the co-chairs. The co-authors. We have bipartisan support, Representatives Tice, Heinrich, Freiberg, Feist, and Ryer. So thank you to my co-authors on this. I'll just briefly touch on the A1 amendment and then I'll go over the bill. The A1 amendment makes two small changes. It first expands the dental residency grants to include advanced education in general dentistry residencies. These residencies are typically based out of community health centers or nonprofit group dental practices. Both these general practice residencies expose dentists to diverse patients, a high percentage of public program enrollees and treatment for children, adults, and elders with complex medical, behavioral, and dental needs. The second portion of that amendment changes the appropriation for the Rural Dentistry Scholars expansion to pass through MDH, and that was on the recommendation of fiscal staff. So that's what the amendment does. And then going into the actual bill, HF 620. As we've already heard in this committee, we know that access to dental care in rural Minnesota remains one of the state's biggest health problems. A 2018 review by DHS found that 55% of Minnesota counties were designated as full county dental health professional shortage areas. Another 7% of counties were partial health professional shortage areas. Looking at the map of Minnesota that was provided in your, you can see how severe the issues are, especially around the state in greater Minnesota. We know, as we've already heard, and again, that poor dental and oral health doesn't stay constrained in just our mouth. The science shows that poor dental health is linked to diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and more. Beyond these health impacts, poor oral health can also impact a person's self-esteem. Preventing poor oral health can sometimes be as simple as just ensuring that people see their dentist regularly. But if people don't have access to dental care, though, these steps become much more difficult. So HF 620 aims to take on this problem by attracting more dentists to work in greater Minnesota in three ways. First, expanding the health professional loan forgiveness program to include dentists who agree to practice in rural areas. Second, creating a new dental residency grant program to support current and new dental residencies outside of the metro area. And the final way, by expanding University of Minnesota's Rural Dentistry Scholars Program. So by both creating new solutions and building on our existing ones, this bill will help attract new dentists to our rural areas. And by addressing this critical shortage of providers, we can protect the health and the residents of greater Minnesota and our state overall. And I do have a letter of support that was included in our packet from the Minnesota Dental Association. And I do have two testifiers, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Damuth. Appreciate that. And so carrying on with our theme here, this is about, I think it was like the third leg of the stool, right? So getting more dentists, getting more providers where we need them. So the first on my list is Sarah Wolfcha, I believe. I'm sorry if I'm saying your name wrong.
Yes, welcome. That's correct.
Welcome. Go ahead, please. Introduce yourself and
give us
your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. My name is Sarah Wolfcha, and I am the Executive Director of Children's Dental Services, which provides a full range of community-based dental care across Minnesota, targeting low-income children and pregnant women, and also serving adults of all ages. I support House File 620. Children's Dental Services serves 37,000 low-income patients annually within 54 Minnesota counties, 42 of which are designated dental professional shortage areas. Children's Dental Services has been posted continuously for a dentist position in rural, northeast, central, and southwest Minnesota over the past 5 years. We've received an average of 2 applications per year and have not been able to fill these positions. As Representative Damuth provided, rural Minnesotans have fewer options for dental care and worse oral health outcomes than their urban counterparts. In Minnesota, the dentist population is 1 dentist per 2,272 small town or rural city residents. 1 dentist per 3,938 residents in rural isolated cities. So for example, we provide care all the way up to Ely and all the way down to Worthington, where there are 2 counties with no dentists at all. And as compared to 1 dentist per 1,601 in our urban regions. At the same time, the average debt of dental school graduates approaches a staggering $300,000. And without loan forgiveness, these dentists simply cannot afford to practice. We must support these dentists to ensure they can serve our most vulnerable Minnesotans and to encourage them to practice in our rural, underserved communities, reaching out to those who need it most. So thank you so much for your attention. And again, I urge you to support House File 620.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome, Dr. Helgeson. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson, the CEO at AppleTree Dental. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of Dental Access Partners, which includes not only AppleTree Dental, but Hennepin Healthcare and Community Dental Care. Together, our three critical access dental organizations serve patients of all ages from 85 of the 87 counties in Minnesota, and more than 80% of the patients we treat are on enrolled in Minnesota public programs. So I want to be personal. At AppleTree, we have six centers for dental health located in rural Minnesota and two in the Twin Cities. And I know firsthand how difficult it is to recruit dental professionals to our rural locations. And that's why supporting all three aspects of House File 620 is so important to me. First, the dental student loan forgiveness with that huge figure of student debt that you heard from Sarah. It's so important. The pressure to earn a high income in an urban setting is enormous. And so having that student loan repayment to get them to settle and practice in a rural area is really critical. Second, the School of Dentistry's Rural Scholars Program brings dental students out into rural communities while they're in dental school. And that is something that helps direct them to practice in a rural community after they graduate. So that's a really important program. And then finally, the dental residencies are really critical. Dental residencies provide that advanced training. And in a rural community, dentists don't have specialists by the scores to refer to. They have to be comfortable doing some pretty advanced things. And residencies are the things that prepare them to do that. And on the medical side, we know when medical residents rotate in rural communities, they tend to practice in rural communities. So all three of these aspects are really critical. And I want to thank Representative Damuth for accepting this friendly amendment to include the AEGD as well as the GPR residents. And in closing, expanding rural oral health workforce is just critical for Minnesota. And this hits on three key topics. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Dr. Helgeson. And I know you've done a lot of great work around the state, very innovative ways to reach folks as well. So I don't see any questions from members. I do have, Representative Munson, go ahead, please.
Sorry, Madam Chair. My question, I guess for the bill's author would be, in line 2.11 to 2.15, we're changing existing statute to say that this a dentist qualifies for this program if they take 25% of public program enrollees or MA patients, or they just agree to practice in the designated rural area. So does that language on 2.15 actually allow people to stop taking MA patients as long as they're practicing normal dentistry in rural areas, that they would continue to be available for this program?
Representative Damuth?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Munson, for the question. As it does read, or that is my understanding, and if I am wrong, I would go to House Fiscal Staff if there's a correction to be made with that.
Representative Munson?
Yeah, I guess I would defer to House research to see if they could answer that question, because as I read it, it sounds like it's taking the bill in the wrong direction.
Ms. Clarkvist.
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, this just makes the dentists eligible for loan forgiveness. So they're eligible for loan forgiveness if they either agree to practice in a rural area or agree to serve that number of public program enrollees.
Okay.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so as it is now, they're available for loan forgiveness if 25% of their patients are medical assistants or state public program enrollees. But it looks like we're no longer making that a requirement for loan forgiveness, and that we're just saying that they have to practice in rural Minnesota, which, I mean, we have plenty of dentists in our area in rural Minnesota, but the really hard part is finding people that take MA. And I think that this language would allow more dentists to stop taking MA and still get loan forgiveness. So I caught that and I had to ask a question, but it's an area of concern for low-income people in my area.
Okay. Representative Damuth, did you want to respond to that at all? You don't have to. I can go on to Representative Ackland, but give you the opportunity.
I would like to. So the intent with adding the access in rural, we're going to leave that public program, is my understanding. We'll leave that public program as it is, but it's something to take into consideration. So I appreciate the clarification asked for as we continue to move through.
All right. Thank you. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Representative Damuth. So the loan forgiveness is granted if a dentist practices in a rural area. And I've seen this similar program with medical students. But on those loan forgiveness, they agree to practice for a certain number of years. And I'm wondering, because I don't think that this has been mentioned, but I'm wondering, saying they need to practice in a rural area, is there a minimum length of time that they would need to practice? Is that included in your bill in that rural area? So what I'm saying is they could get the loan forgiveness, practice 3 years, and then move on. Is that a possibility here, or do you have some more parameters around their practice?
Representative Dama?
Thank you. I'm just grabbing my papers here. They would get the loan forgiveness while they are practicing in the rural area, but if they would leave, then it would end.
And maybe we could get clarification on that too from Ms. Clarkquist if she can just, and you know, just members realize too, this is a great discussion, and I think it can be uncomfortable for an author to have members kind of say, here's what about this and what about, but we are laying the bill over, so if we have money to be able to do some of this, there is opportunity to amend it as well. So I'm sure Representative Damuth is taking notes. Ms. Clarkquist.
Madam Chair and Representative Ackland, I think it's a 3-year service obligation, and that's in another subdivision in this loan forgiveness program.
Okay, great. Great clarification. Representative Ackland, anything further? All right, thank you. And I do have a question for Representative Damuth, and that is, Representative Damuth, I think that the bill has a blank appropriation. And I realize that at this stage, that's okay. But I just wondered, this is the kind of bill that at some point somebody has to decide, given if there's money available, somebody has to decide how much does it take? How much money will make a difference here? And I don't know if you are prepared to answer that or one of your testifiers, but I could say perhaps, facetiously, oh, well, here's $5. Is that going to be helpful? Well, no, obviously. So, how much will it take to impact any of these things that you've got in the bill? That's something that, as a fiscal chair, having it laid over in our bill, it's going to be kind of a key question. So do you have any kind of response to that, or should I go to one of the testifiers?
I actually do. And thank you for the question, Madam Chair. As we've heard throughout this committee, we know that the need is great. And so we would like to put as much money forward as we could. But I think what we'll do is, as we move forward, we'll, as you get your targets too, but we'll work with the dental associations and the other stakeholders to determine what the actual need would be, how we could serve more and get the program started and moving forward in a way that will be helpful.
Okay, well, that would be great, Representative Damuth, if you could, when you come back to us and when your helpers come back to us with this, if you could try to quantify sort of what do we get for how much money, so that we have a sense of how many scholarships, how many dental students can we get out into these areas and so on, just so we have some scalability or some sense of the scale of what different amounts of investment would buy for the state would be helpful. So other questions from members? All right. Any closing comments, Representative Damon?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill. And I want to thank the testifiers for what they've shared and the support and the member questions. I think this is the perfect example of how we can make things better as we move forward. So I appreciate the questions. Yes, I have taken notes and I'll continue to work on it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for bringing the bill. And this is, you know, this is a big puzzle, as we've said on some of the other bills that we've heard here today. It's multifaceted and we're going to have to, you know, keep trying to approach it from a lot of different angles so that every Minnesotan has the dental care that they need and deserve. And that is so important, as we know, as we've heard from you and others, Representative Damon. So with that, the bill, House File 620, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So with that, I think that is all of our business for today. Unless there are any questions or concerns, our next meeting is on Monday, and we'll be getting the agenda out to everyone. So with that, thank you, members. Thank you, testifiers and staff. We are adjourned.